Welcome back to The Deep Dive. Today we're tackling a name so fundamental to Western literature that, well, we're not even sure he was a real person.
Right.
We're talking about Homer, the poet behind the Iliad and the Odyssey.
And our guide for this is the brilliant classicist Barbara Graziosi, and specifically her work, Homer, a cultural biography.
And the mission here, as you said before we started, is not to get lost in that old, unanswerable question of who Homer was.
No, absolutely not. We're asking something much more interesting, I think. We're asking, what have people for the last 3,000 years made Homer mean?
That's a huge shift in perspective.
It is.
It moves us away from this modern obsession we have with, you know, finding the one single author, the lone genius.
Exactly. And what Graziosi shows is that with Homer, that whole idea just falls apart.
So by looking at the idea of Homer, we're really learning how foundational stories, how they stay alive.
Right. They don't survive by being set in stone. They survive because every generation reinterprets them, adapts them, makes them their own. It's a fascinating process.
Before we really dive in, let's talk a bit about our guide here. Who is Barbara Graziosi?
She's a major figure in the world of classics. She's a professor at Princeton University, and her specialty is ancient Greek literature, especially the epics.
But she has a particular angle, right? You mentioned reception studies. For anyone who hasn't heard that term, what does it actually mean?
It's a great question. Reception studies, it basically stops asking, what did the author intend?
Okay.
And instead it asks, how has this poem or this book been read and used and changed by different people throughout history? It treats the text like it's alive, not like it's a fossil.
So she's not just looking at the Greek grammar of the Iliad.
No, not at all.
She's also looking at how, say, a Renaissance poet or a modern filmmaker took that story and did something new with it.
That's exactly. And that's why she writes as a cultural historian here, not just a literary critic. She's taking these huge centuries-long debates and she's distilling them into this amazing story. It's the biography of an idea.
Okay, so if we had to put the book's central thesis on an index card, what would it say?
I love that. It would say something like, Homer is not one person we can dig up and find.
Right.
He is a powerful, ever-changing cultural idea that stands for a whole poetic tradition. The poems have lasted because they can be endlessly reinterpreted.
So we have to stop trying to force our modern idea of authorship onto this ancient oral tradition.
We have to. Great literature back then didn't just come from one person in a room. It was, you know, a dialogue, a cultural conversation.
It really pushes back against that myth of the isolated genius.
It does, and it makes the whole Homeric question, you know, was he one person or many? Was he blind? It makes all of that seem like a bit of a distraction.
And Graziosi lays this out for us in four parts, right?
Yep, a very clear roadmap. First, the fictional life that was invented for him. Then, his work, the poems themselves. After that, the historical world they describe. And finally, his reception, that incredible afterlife.
So let's start with the man, or the myth of the man. The ancient Greeks started inventing these biographies for him, didn't they?
They did, and they were all contradictory. He was born in seven different cities, he was blind, he was poor.
Why? Why invent those things?
Well, that's Graziosi's key point. These stories weren't history, they were projections. They were what later cultures needed their ideal poet to be.
So if you want a poet to have some kind of divine insight, you make him blind to the ordinary world.
Exactly. Or if your city wants some cultural bragging rights, you just claim Homer was born there.
This gets us to the big debate between the Annalists and the Unitarians.
Right. The Annalists who thought the poems were stitched together and the Unitarians who insisted on a single author.
But modern scholarship with Perry and Lord has sort of settled that, hasn't it?
It really has. They studied living oral poets in the Balkans and realized these epic poems weren't memorized. They were improvised during performance using set formulas.
That's where you get the repeated phrases like swift-footed Achilles or rosy-fingered Dawn.
Yes. Those aren't just decorative. They're metrical tools, building blocks a poet could use on the fly to keep the rhythm going.
So the modern consensus is that Homer was probably one incredibly gifted poet who gave the tradition its final monumental shape.
That's it. But he was standing on the shoulders of centuries of other poets. The search for the real Homer is, as Graziosi puts it, a red herring.
And once we accept that, we can just focus on the poems themselves.
Right.
Let's start with the Iliad. It's all about the rage of Achilles.
His manus. The poem seems simple on the surface. Achilles gets angry, stops fighting, and everything goes wrong for the Greeks. But it's so much more than a war story.
Graziosi calls it a meditation on mortality, right?
It's a profound one. It's about the cost of chasing glory, Kleos, and the sheer human suffering of war. It's really an anti-war poem in many ways.
I always think of that scene where Hector, the great Trojan hero, says goodbye to his wife and baby son.
It's devastating.
It brings this huge epic war down to one terrified family. It's so personal.
And that empathy is what defines the poem. Think about the very end in book 24. Achilles has been dragging Hector's body around in his rage. Mm. And then Hector's old father, King Priam, sneaks into the Greek camp to beg for his son's body back.
It's one of the most moving scenes in all of literature.
It is. Because Priam makes Achilles think of his own father, and suddenly these two enemies, the killer and the father of the man he killed, they weep together.
They find their shared humanity in grief.
Yes. It stops being a story about Greeks versus Trojans and becomes a story about humanity, a tragedy for everyone.
Now, compare that tight, intense focus of the Iliad to the Odyssey.
Oh, they're completely different. The Odyssey is this sprawling adventure that covers 10 years of travel. The theme isn't rage, it's homecoming nostos.
And the hero, Odysseus, is defined by a totally different quality.
Cunning intelligence. Moretus. He's the man of many turns. He solves problems with his mind, not just his sword.
The Cyclops is the classic example.
The perfect example. He knows he can't just kill the monster in his sleep.
Because then they'd be trapped in the cave.
Exactly. So he has to blind him. And he tells the Cyclops his name is Nobody. So when the other Cyclops ask, who's hurting him?
He shouts, nobody is killing me.
It's just brilliant. The whole poem is about identity, civilization versus barbarism, and storytelling itself. Odysseus is constantly telling stories to survive.
And we can't forget the smart female characters like Penelope.
Absolutely not. She's his equal in cunning. That trick with the burial shroud, weaving it by day and unraveling it at night to hold off the suitors. She's a master strategist in her own right.
Okay, let's shift to the world of Homer. Graziosi makes it very clear these poems are not history books.
Not at all. She calls it a composite world. It's a poetic fiction, a blend of different eras.
So you get things from the much older Bronze Age, like that famous boar's tusk helmet.
Mixed right in with social structures and technologies from the later period when the poems were actually being written down.
So their truth isn't factual, it's poetic.
It's poetic, and it's functional. The poems created a shared heroic past for the Greeks. They gave them a sense of common identity and values.
Which leads us perfectly into the final part of the book, Homer's afterlife, his reception.
Yes, this incredible 3,000-year journey.
So Homer became the basis of all Greek education, but he was also controversial from the start.
He was, and his biggest critic was Plato.
Right. Why did Plato have such a problem with him?
Well, Plato wanted to build a perfect, rational society. And in Homer's poems, the gods are constantly fighting, having affairs, being petty.
They're not good role models.
Not at all. And the heroes are driven by grief and rage. Plato was worried that listening to these stories would make citizens irrational and immoral. He essentially wanted to ban Homer.
It's like the first argument about media literacy.
It really is. Then, a bit later, you get the scholars at the Library of Alexandria.
And their job was to create a standard version.
A huge moment. They took all these different oral versions and created a fixed written text. That act of editing was what allowed the poems to be preserved and transmitted so consistently.
And the reinvention just keeps going. The Romans, with Virgil's Aeneid.
A direct response. Virgil basically writes a Roman Homer, an epic that justifies Rome's destiny to rule the world. It's a brilliant piece of cultural appropriation.
Fast forward to the modern era, and translation becomes the key. George Chapman's translation inspired the poet Keats.
And just recently, Emily Wilson's translation of the Odyssey, the first into English by a woman, has been a huge bestseller.
Because she brought a whole new set of modern questions about power and gender to the text.
And that's Graziosi's entire point. Whether it's Joyce's Ulysses or the Coen brothers movie, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? Homer stays alive because we keep making him new.
So let's try to pull out the biggest themes here. The real aha moments from the book.
Okay, I think the first one is simply Homer as a cultural construct.
Right.
The power of these poems comes from the tradition, the community, not from one single person. Our whole obsession with individual authorship is, you know, a pretty modern anxiety.
And that leads right to the second one, which is that this constant reinterpretation is actually the engine of survival.
Yes. Great art doesn't survive by staying the same. It survives by being adapted, by becoming perpetually different. Every culture creates the Homer it needs.
Theme 3 feels like it's about the nature of truth. Poetic truth versus historical fact.
Mm-hmm. The epics aren't valuable because they're factually accurate. They're valuable because they explore these deep human truths about anger and home and identity and loss.
And that kind of truth doesn't expire.
It never does. And that brings us to the last one. Reading is a conversation. When you read Homer today, you're not just passively receiving some ancient wisdom.
You're an active participant.
You're bringing all of your modern concerns to the table. What our film adaptations of Homer say tells us a lot more about us than it does about the ancient Greeks.
The book must be full of really memorable lines that sum these things up.
It is. I mean, to paraphrase one of her key ideas on identity, the quest to find the real Homer is a mistake. He isn't a man we can discover, but a cultural tradition we're all a part of.
I love that. It reframes the whole project.
And on the Iliad, she says something like, "The Iliad is not a celebration of war. It is a deeply moving account of its cost. The ultimate truth of war is shared human suffering."
Yeah, that gets to the heart of that scene with Priam and Achilles.
It does. And finally, on reading itself, every act of reading or translating Homer is an act of creation. We are in a dynamic conversation with the text.
It's so empowering for the reader. It says your interpretation matters.
And that's a huge shift. And it has some really practical applications for today.
How so?
Well, for one, the whole Homeric question is a perfect training ground for source criticism and media literacy.
Okay, explain that.
It teaches you to be skeptical of any neat and tidy origin story. Whether it's a national myth or a corporate founding story, you have to ask, who is telling the story and why? What purpose does it serve?
It's about understanding that narratives are constructed for a reason.
Exactly. And in an age of information overload and misinformation, that skill is it's essential.
And what about on a more personal level?
Well, there's Odysseus. His reliance on manatis, on cunning intelligence over brute force, is a fantastic model for problem solving. It's about strategy, patience, adaptability. In a complex world, you can't just charge ahead. You have to be smart.
Odysseus is the patron saint of the strategic pivot.
And I suppose on a bigger scale, her whole book is a model for understanding cultural foundations.
That's a great way to put it. It shows you how these core stories shape a society's identity. And understanding that process is key to understanding the world.
So after this whole deep dive, what's the one big takeaway for you?
For me, it's that the classics aren't these dusty things on a shelf. They're living, breathing entities. Their power comes from their flexibility, not from having one fixed meaning that we have to uncover. They are reborn with every reader. What surprised me most, I think, was just how psychologically real the heroes are, which is why they can be reinterpreted so endlessly.
Right.
Achilles isn't just an angry warrior. He has this profound capacity for empathy. And Penelope isn't just a waiting wife. She's an intelligent, resilient political leader holding her world together for 20 years. They're messy and complicated and completely human.
A conversation that spans millennia.
It certainly is. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Acontra Foundation.